Thanks. Sorry for that delay. All right, so thank you for joining us this afternoon. My name is Lynn Ward, and I'm a team lead with the Program Training and Consultation Center, and I'll be moderating today's webinar, Tobacco Control in Ontario, How Well Are We Doing, and Where Can We Improve? Findings from OTRU's Annual Strategy Monitoring Report. If anyone is having trouble logging onto the webinar, please call PTCC's 1-800 number at 1-800-363-7822. For those of you who are logged into our webinar, you will see the presentation on your right. On the left side of the screen, you'll see a chat box. We've set aside time for your questions throughout the presentation, so please feel free to enter your questions into this box and we'll address them throughout the presentation when possible. We'll also set some time aside at the end of the presentation. Before we begin, we'd like to get a better sense of how many have joined us today, so please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number. Okay, thanks very much, everyone. So I'd like to introduce you to our two speakers today. First up is Dr. Sean O'Connor. Sean is a senior research associate at OTRU and an expert in the surveillance of tobacco control outcomes. Sean leads the strategy evaluation working group at OTRU, which produces the report being discussed today. Our second speaker, who of course many of you know as well, is Dr. Rob Schwartz. Rob is the Executive Director of OTRU and a professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. He has interest in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Rob and Sean.
Thank you very much. And this is Rob. Even though I'm second, I'm going first. And it's a pleasure to be back with you again. This year, we're doing this particular webinar on our annual strategy monitoring report later than usual. The reason for that is that the data just has not come in that we wanted to have. So this is a frustration that we have, and I'm sure you share the frustration, and share that frustration with the powers that be, and maybe we can do something about it. In any case, we usually have this webinar in January, and we, at that time, would have results from the Canadian Community Health Survey, CCHS, and from CTAS every other year, the Canadian Tobacco and Drug Survey. Unfortunately, this year, Ontario level data for both of those surveys was delayed. It should have been out and it was delayed, and so we delayed the report and we delayed it a bit more. And now we're at the end of the fiscal, so we said we're publishing this report. The full report usually is sent out to you. You will receive it within about a week's time. You should have received the executive summary by email from PTCC this morning. The slides from the webinar will be shared with you in about a week's time as well. Today, unlike some of the previous webinars, we don't have a lot of really new news on some of the main indicators. However, there is some new news, and we do have two surveys that have come in, population surveys that were done since we last reported. That is CAMH Monitor for 2015, and OSDAS also for 2015. So those are both Ontario surveys, and we will be presenting today some data from there. Of course, there are also developments in the tobacco control environment. We have some exciting new measures that have been implemented in Ontario. The health units and the TCANs, as well as the provincial partners, have been doing some great work. And we will reflect that as we go through. So just a reminder to those of you, there may be some people who are new who've never heard this webinar, so just to remind you that we have been doing this since 1994, in the full report you will see that we have several chapters, six in total. Today we will be talking a little bit about each of those chapters. We will have a few polling questions during the webinar, and please do feel free to ask your questions in the chat box. We really would like to have some interaction as much as possible. We'll start with some key issues that we've identified. So is tobacco use different from cigarette use? Just at a meeting yesterday, people continue to be confused to think that cigarette use makes up all of tobacco use. Are emerging products an issue? Well, I sure think they are. I just came back from the Society for Research on Nicotine and Tobacco, and I think there are more presentations and posters about emerging products, if you include e-cigarettes in that category, than anything else. Does smoking increase gradually with age, or does the rate jump? So you probably have an answer to that, but today we're going to have a new surprising finding. I think surprising finding around that, which is actually a good news finding, so stay tuned. Are Ontarians quitting smoking? Well, I sure hope so, with all of the effort going into the cessation system, but we will be presenting some data that is not all that encouraging. Is there a need to increase price and tax? Well, who are you talking to? Well, it's pretty clear what our answer to that is. And are we finished with protection? So we've made great strides in the past year in protecting more Ontarians from exposure to secondhand smoke in the outdoors, and we will see where we are and what still needs to be done during the course of the presentation today. Important to always, when we're monitoring or evaluating the strategy, to think about, well, what are the goals against which we're monitoring? And the official goal of the Smoke Free Ontario strategy, as far as I can understand it, is that Ontario aims to be the Canadian jurisdiction with the lowest smoking rate. That should be cigarette smoking rate. We are assuming that means current cigarette smoking. There's a bit of play possible in there. Currently, British Columbia holds the lead on Ontario, and if this is indeed the goal, then all we need to do is to beat out British Columbia. And we are making progress each year, but guess what? So is British Columbia. So that is a tough goal to achieve. Another goal that has been shopped around in the past 7-8 years is to decrease the prevalence of smoking by 5 percentage points over a 5-year period. That was the TSAG, Tobacco Strategy Advisory Group goal that was written in the 2010 report. So far, we're not there. So far, in the past 5 years, ending 2014, because we don't have better data, and we'll talk a bit more about that, in the 5 years ending 2014, we had only a 2 percentage point decline. So despite all of our great efforts, we still are not seeing that more quick decrease in the prevalence of smoking. We are hopeful that when we see the 2015 data, we'll have better news, but we can't say until we see it. Another goal that, personally, and I'm sure many, I would hope all of you who are listening, I was so happy when I saw the announcement from the Federal Minister of Health, Jane Philpott, saying that Canada is adopting a tobacco endgame goal of less than 5% by the year 2035. With this, we join a small family of nations across the world who have officially adopted endgame goals. This is an exciting development and opportunity. The Federal Tobacco Control Strategy is being renewed with that goal in mind. And I personally am hopeful that as the Smoke Free Ontario strategy is being modernized in the language of the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, that Ontario too will perhaps consider an end-game goal, perhaps one that's even more ambitious. So there's some good news. I'm just going to give a little bit of some of the overview key things. Amongst young people in particular, things are looking better. Among high school students, past 30-day cigarette use is down by 60% over the last decade. Indeed, you'll see some very nice numbers when we present the prevention chapter. The second point, I think, is one of the most of the things that really jumped out at me as we were doing the monitoring this year, because young adults is where we have really been saying, well, that's where we're not seeing a lot of progress. So for the first time this year, we do see a significant decrease in the prevalence of smoking in what we're calling young adults. This is the 20 to 24-year age group. It's down to 17%. Okay, so that is a nice piece of news. We should all pat ourselves on the shoulders. The older young adults, not so good. We'll come to that. Increasing reach of some cessation supports and of cessation training. As we know, we are now protecting more people outdoors. And we have a flavor prohibition in place. And actually, since January of this year, a menthol prohibition in place. And so we are actually doing some evaluation of both of those, which we will present to you another time. Some less good news. Lots of new stuff happening. So e-cigarettes, the story is still unclear on the uptake of e-cigarettes by people who would otherwise not have smoked regular cigarettes. The story is still unclear whether e-cigarettes are actually helping a significant proportion of Ontario smokers to quit smoking. Then we have new things on the market now. We have heat-not-burn products, and I just looked at a slide presentation yesterday from one of the tobacco companies, and they are coming out with new transformative, potentially disruptive technologies that may be good news for us, but they may be bad news for us. And we do have an OTRU update on heat not burns that is very cautious. These things are very far from benign, even if they are slightly less harmful than smoking tobacco cigarettes. As I say, older young adults, the 25 to 29-year-old smoking remains high. We're not seeing, unfortunately, despite everything, yet, we're not seeing significantly more quit attempts and long-term quits. And despite the many years that we've already had measures in place to protect youth in particular from secondhand smoke exposure, you can see on the slide 25% are still exposed in public places, 8% in homes, and 5% in cars. Now, you might take that with a bit of grain of salt. I'm exposed every day to secondhand smoke when I walk outside. I don't like it. I consider myself exposed, and I think that we haven't succeeded in tobacco control until that stops. But obviously, there are many constraints on fixing that one. The exposure in multi-unit housing is now measured at 15%. That's down substantially from the previous year measure, and I think we need to be cautious about reporting on that one. You can see the M there, so there's a moderate level of reportability of that statistic, and it may be because the previous one was closer to 30%. So I don't want us to pat ourselves on the shoulder yet. I'm not sure. As you know, there is some noise in data and large confidence intervals. So it's one, to be cautiously optimistic about, but we're not so sure about that one. So we have been meeting some of the standards that we against which we measure ourselves. That's MPOWER, the World Health Organization, based on some of the minimum standards of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And the SAC standards, that is the Scientific Advisory Committee standards, which were the recommendations made in 2010 by what I'm calling now the SAC 1 committee. The SAC 2 report will be available shortly. We will have a bit of an issue, Sean and I and our team at OTRU, in monitoring and evaluating against that report because there are not recommendations in that report. So we'll have to figure that one out. Patio ban is in. Flavor ban is almost all in, except for some whiskey types of flavors. There's lots of monitoring and evaluation going on, although we really do need more resources to do it better, and we do need much better surveillance, more frequent and less time lagged, and more questions on population-level surveys. We're not sure if we're doing sufficient targeting of high-risk youth and of young adults, and we know that building our cessation system is a work in progress, and we have been saying that for a long time, but I'm hopeful that this time round, in a short time, we will see more of that happening. And the flip side, there's still stuff that is not there. Our taxes are way too low. Okay, I won't go into my diatribe on that. Our mass media and social marketing is not meeting the standard. We still don't cover our cessation supports. We do not have adult ratings when they're smoking in movies. And there are some public places where people still are not protected. So that is all by way of introduction and overview. And now we're going to go into a little more detail. And for that, we are going to hand it over to Sean O'Connor, who's going to do the tobacco use section.
All right. Yeah, so I've got a few slides on tobacco use. And we'll speak for a little bit, and we'll pass it back to Rob after a while to pick up on cessation. But with respect to tobacco use, we have some new and old data. Some of the older data is as a result of the CCHS not being updated. But we see here tobacco use, and this is cigarette, cigar, smokeless tobacco, and pipe. Combined, it was 19.6 in 2014. And that's significantly lower than that reported in 2010, which was 22%. So that's good news. And I know the CCHS in 2015, when it's released, it actually, for the first time, will include a question on e-cigarette use. So we'll be able to look at cigarette, cigar, smokeless pipe, and e-cigarette on the same data source. So that's good news. The bad news, of course, is that we lose the trend because the CCHS 2015 is going to be considered a new source of information that can't be compared to previous years. So that's the downside. Is tobacco use different from cigarette use? So we see here the bottom line is cigarette use. So this is past 30-day use. All these questions, have you used this substance in the past 30 days? We see 17% compared to 4% for cigars, and 1% for the other items with the use of snuff, not reportable. But the use of chewing tobacco and snuff combined is basically 1% amongst 12 years and over. So in this case, we do see that cigarette use is still king. Later on, when I report on cigarette use, we're going to use a slightly different definition. It's going to be past 30-day use, but 100 cigarettes in lifetime in the future slides. So cigar use, as mentioned, 4% for 12 years and older the past month. And here's a cigar use broken down by age. So we see the very last slide, males and females, for 12 years and over, 1% for females, 7% for males. So it really, and we see that pattern all the way through. The green bars are much lower than the purple bars. So this, this is telling us that cigar use is particularly a problem with males. And if we look at the age groups here, we can see it's a particular problem amongst young adult males. It's 2 to 4 times higher, depending on which age group we see here. The M is marginal for marginal estimate to interpret with caution, and that's just because there's not a lot of females smoking these products as well. So just caution on those numbers. The flavored cigar market. So this is 2015 data. So we see that basically 83% of the market of cigars is flavored. Now, this is going to be really interesting to look when we get the 2016 data. And again, it'll be interesting when we get the 2017 data because, as we know, in 2016, flavors were prohibited. In 2017, menthol was prohibited. So this, we're expecting, should change. And arguably that 4% of cigar use might change as well if people are actually leaving the market of cigars. So we see the menthol, it's comprises 4% of all cigar sales. It would probably be much higher if you just looked at youth and young adult, but in terms of, this is wholesale sales data from Health Canada. Current cigarette smoking is 16.1%. So previously we reported 17% for cigarette smoking, and that was just past 3 days. Now we're switching to past 3 days and 100 cigarettes in lifetime, and that's the definition we use, just to, you know, for historical reasons and a few other reasons, but that's the definition from here on out that will be reported. So again, we do see a significant decrease in cigarette smoking amongst 12 years and over. It was 18% in 2010. In 2014, it's 16%. Looking at it over time, we can see the very last bar, 2014, it's 16%. The little line on top is the confidence interval. So really the number falls somewhere within that bar. And that's true for all the, that is the black and the black line at the top of the green bar. So we see here that in 2010 it was 18%, in 2014 it's 16%, and that's the comparison years that we've looked at 5 years ago. But we can see from, you know, from the very beginning, from 2000-2001, it was something like 23-24%, right? So we're down to 16. So over a large period of time, it has dropped quite substantially. Here's a slide. This is just the 13-14 data. It's 2 years combined because we've broken up the sample into the 36 public health units in Ontario, so we needed the combined 13-14 year to make these estimates reliable. And we see at Peel, you know, they range from a low at of 10% or about 11% in Peel, right up to 25% or higher in Brant, Peterborough, and Nisqually. The Ontario average, as mentioned, is 16. So we see some variation across the province, and as a general statement, it's typically higher rates in the north, but not entirely. So here's a new analysis, which was, it's new in this year's report. This is a subpopulation analysis, so this is the rate of smoking for those groups that have a rate of 25% or more. So the very first two items there, I know this is small font, I'm hoping people can see this, but the first 12 years and over, it's 16% as we mentioned, 18 years and over is 18%, but all the other ones are subpopulations. And we can see, we can group these to some extent, but if your income is below 15,000, you've got a high rate of smoking. You know, we've got culture background Aboriginal, which is the term is used in CCHS, is 33.5%. Now that is just off reserve. This survey didn't sample on reserve. So if we sampled on reserve, if it did sample on reserve, this number would be that much higher. But it's, and then we see occupations. We see occupations, again, it's what's traditionally been referred to as blue-collar workers. Trades, manufacturing, primary industry is quite a bit higher. And so we can see the values. I won't go into all these. We can see the values, but also of interest is the populations. Some of the populations are quite tiny. Some of them are quite large. And so in public health, there's always a push and pull. You're interested in populations that have a high prevalence, and a high population. So, again, if you're targeting like a public relations campaign or or a social marketing campaign or just trying to reach a large number of people, you want either one or hit priority groups that have a high burden of smoking and have a high population so you can reach them from a population perspective. But there's also another perspective that, you want to reach high percentage or high rates of smoking irrespective of whether the population is high or not, because they have that population has a particular burden. So, for instance, Aboriginal, it's only 96,000 people, but, 33.5% on off-reserve smoke, so quite a bit high. And one can make that analogy throughout these priority populations, special populations, whatever term you want to use.
Also, taking into account that the total number of smokers in Ontario is estimated at about 2 million. Right, so it's important to have the equity perspective and always to keep in mind that we need to also focus on those smokers in population groups that have the largest numbers.
That's right, yeah. A couple of things of note is if you do look at the occupations that are listed here, there's 300,000 for trades, another 92,000 for manufacturing, and 36,000 for primary industry. So if you added those three up together, that's quite a significant percent value of smoking, but also quite a significant population value. Chronic disease, number with mood disorders, 300,000. Chronic disease risk factors, 500,000. Large population. So it kind of meets both a high rate of smoking and a large population. But again, it's not all about the population. If a group is burdened with a high rate of smoking, that justifies policies and programming directed towards that, irrespective of whether or not they have a significant population or not. So moving forward, we have a poll question. So the question is, which alternative product has the highest rate of past year use amongst adults? So this is past year use. Have you used an e-cigarette? Each question would have been derived. Have you used an e-cigarette in the past year? Have you used a water pipe in the past year? Have you used cannabis in the past year? So we have a polling question here for you. So if people take a few minutes and respond, we get responses coming in quickly now. We've got over 30 responses. It seems to be between e-cigarettes and cannabis, they're close, with some answering water pipe. So we seem to be fairly split. So without giving the answer right away, we're going to go through each of these substances. So from the CAMH monitor, which is 18 plus, we have past month, which is 3%. Past year is 11%. Lifetime is 15%. So keep in mind, past year is 11%. That's the frame of reference for the question.
But also keep in mind that past year use of e-cigarettes is not a great measure.
That's right.
And that only 3% of Ontarians used an e-cigarette in the past month, which also is not a great measure, but that's for another time.
Yeah. I mean, it is important to really emphasize that, though, that if you're from an evaluation point of view, surveillance point of view, you really want to look at immediate behavior. Like, have you smoked in the past month? Are you a daily smoker? And with e-cigarettes, there's some challenges in terms of definitional issues. But we would prefer to have a very small time frame to look back. Unfortunately, it's not always there, and we'll see that as we present the data for water pipe and cannabis. That there's no survey questions that ask that immediate kind of, are you a current kind of user of these products. So we defer to past year and lifetime. But for the poll question, past year is 11% is the frame of reference. Moving to water pipe, we have lifetime use. Again, we don't have past year, but lifetime for 15 years and over is 8%. For 18 years and older on the CAMH monitor in 2012, it was 2%. So a little bit definitional issues here, but it's definitely, this is lower than what was reported for past year use for e-cigarette, which was 11%. So although different definitions, from these comparison of water pipe and e-cigarette use is king in terms it had as the higher burden for past year use, we can infer. Going to cannabis, past year use 32% compared to I think 11% for e-cigarette use. So cannabis is king here, right? Large burden. Now if we looked at past 30-day use, it may be different, right? But we don't have past 3-day use, so we're a little bit blind. We would like to have that though. Lifetime use, almost half of all adults in Ontario have used cannabis, 45%. So this is really the first year we've reported on cannabis, and we have a number of figures of cannabis in the report, so I encourage people to look at that. Our tobacco informatics monitoring system, which a lot of these numbers are based on, has a new, a recent section added to it on e-cigarettes, so you can go to the e-cigarette tab and look at e-cigarette numbers from CAMH Monitor. This year, we've also included a cannabis tab, so you can go in and look at cannabis indicators on the TIN system, which is also from the CAMH Monitor, and over the next month or so, we'll add the OSDUS on that, and this summer we'll add CCHS and CTAD, so we're broadening out the TIMS, the Tobacco Informatics Monitoring System. So it's tims.otru.org. You can get a majority of the numbers that we're presenting today. So we have just a brief time for questions. I guess we'll just see if there are questions.
Yeah, there are a couple of questions in the chat box, Sean.
Okay. So let me just maybe scroll up. So Michael Perley has a question. Would you consider IQOS a tobacco product or an e-cig product for purposes of regulation? Ministry could use either the ECA or the SFOA.
Thanks for the question, Michael. There's no question in my mind that IQOS, which is a heat-not-burn product, for those who may not be familiar, it's basically a small cigarette that you insert into a pen-like device, which heats it up, and you inhale what is called some sort of vapor or aerosol. There's no question that this is a tobacco product, because there is tobacco in those small cigarettes that get heated. And that is, I know, the way that Health Canada is relating to it. So IQOS would definitely be a tobacco product, in my opinion. Yeah. You may want to curate the questions.
Yeah,
sorry. Okay, so there's a second question here, also from Michael. How will OTRU reconcile its reference to M-Power standards with the less than 5% by 2035 federal recommendation? Shouldn't we be using a more aggressive standard?
So we use more than one standard. The M-Power is a minimum standard that we compare against because we feel that Ontario should at least be meeting that standard, and it isn't. It's very close for the most part, but there are some key parts that are missing. In addition, we've been using the SAC recommendations, and of course we're looking at the ultimate goal, which is decreased prevalence. All the time. I think it will be very useful if the stakeholders set up some milestones along the less than 5 by 2035 continuum timeline and say, well, okay, so then by 2020 we should be at X, and by 2025 at Y, 2030 at Z. And that would certainly be a very helpful thing for us to do in our monitoring.
Yeah, just to add that, you know, the M-Power is really for countries around the world, including low and middle income countries. So, you know, you're kind of comparing standards to a low income country. For Ontario, it's not quite, it doesn't quite resonate with us. But it is a standard, and we're not meeting all the standards of M-Power, so that's why we're using it, and also just the paucity of having, you know, the paucity of standards out there which we can compare to. So we're continuously looking for kind of authoritative assessments of where the SFO stands in relation to other, and we'll continue to revise that that other standard to the extent that we can in the future.
All right. Before we move on, another question has come in. So how do we know Health Canada is dealing with IQOS as a tobacco product? So the product we talked about earlier, the heat-not-burn.
I've heard them say it orally at meetings. But one could ask them.
Thanks. So as always, we encourage you to type your questions into the chat box.
All right, so moving on to prevention, there's a few slides here that we'll present, and then I'll pass it over to Rob for cessation and protection. So one question we have, it's not a poll question, but does smoking increase gradually with age, or does the rate jump? And this is something I've heard people in posing questions to O2, they wanted to, you know, they want to know this type of thing and what's happening. So this is a slide. This is lifetime absence. So these folks have never used tobacco. So in grade 7, we see 98% people in grade 7 have never used tobacco. That goes to 93% in grade 8. And, yeah. And 89% grade 9, and then in grade 10, it does look like it's significantly lower at 80%, going down to grade 12 at 68%. So the next slide has it in a bar chart. So that last column, 2015, are the numbers I've just looked at, but we do see it over a 12-year period here. And we do see that over time, that the rates of lifetime abstinence have increased significantly. So in 2003, for instance, it was 80% for grade 7. Now it's 98%. And we can see that change all the way through. So, I mean, what this is telling us is that smoking is really not a huge issue for those lower grades. It's really when people are entering high school that it starts to become a particular issue. People in grade 9, again, 89% have indicated that they've used tobacco at some level. And then in grade 12, it's 68%. So as we go through with the next couple of slides looking at rates of smoking in past year and lifetime, we'll get a better sense of some of these transitions. So past year smoking, so that have you smoked at all in the past year? Not reportable for the younger grades. In grade 9, though, it's 8%. Grade 10, double that, 16%. So in grade 10, if you ask someone in grade 10 if you smoked in the past year, they're kind of reflecting on their grade 9 experience because of, you know, past year. So we do see that this jump kind of happens in high school, and it typically happens, you know, it starts to happen in grade 9. And, you know, arguably there's this other jump, there's a maturation. Grade 12 is 24%, right? So that gets quite high too. So this slide, again, it's the same information for 2015 that we just reported. This is a trend. So just as a short note, the line chart here, on the left-hand side, on percent, it goes 0, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. That's the percentage of people that smoke in the past year. Along the bottom axis are years, 2003 to 2015. So if you look at the very right side, that's the 2015 numbers, and we see that there has been a gradual decline over time, though it is quite flat in recent years. So this is current smoking the past 30 days. So we see it's, you know, extremely low for, this is OSDS again, grades 9 to 10, 2%. In rates of smoking, that's you know, significantly lower than the 5% for grade 11 and 12. But even 5% is three times lower than what it was over a decade ago at 15% in 2003. So some good news. We have seen over time the age of uptake of smoking has pushed, it's moved back in terms of the later grades. Hopefully that'll be a trend that continues, though. Everything has changed the last 5 years with e-cigarette use. We don't know for sure if people are migrating to e-cigarettes or to cannabis for that matter. And in talking to my son, who's in grade 12 over the last few years, he's like, you know, cigarettes, no one wants to smoke a cigarette, but cannabis no one wants to smoke an e-cigarette either, because there is no such thing as an e-cigarette for a teenager. They're vape pens or vaping, right? They don't consider it a cigarette. It's a vaping device. So that's a whole other thing that we need to keep our eye on in terms of the overall usage of these products. And as I mentioned before, for the first time in 2015, CCHS will add a question on e-cigarette use. We'll be able to add that into an overall kind of omnibus measure of substance abuse or substance use. Current smoking past 3 days. So this is a different data source and a different age group. So we see amongst 15 and 17 and 18 and 19-year-olds, the bottom two lines, it's quite low, particularly for 15 to 17-year-olds at 3%. Gets three times higher when you're 18 to 19, and then jumps up to 17% for 20 to 24-year-olds and 23% for 25 to 29-year-olds. So just looking from 2000, we pick five-year periods to compare the data to. So from 2010 to 2014, for that yellow line, the second from the bottom, it goes from 25 to 17, so that is a significant decrease. You know, there could be some variability there. It looks like the numbers are jumping around, so it'll be interesting to keep this on our monitoring
radar,
yeah, and so we'll monitor that. But for now, it is a significant decrease for that younger adults. For the older adults, 25 to 29, there hasn't been any decline. It's been around 25 to 23% for the last 5 years or so. So are emerging products an issue? And we have a poll question. So this, which product has the highest rate of past year use amongst grade 7 to 12 students in Ontario? Cigarettes, e-cigarettes, water pipe, and cannabis. So folks could answer this. Now you got to ask yourself, am I trying to trick you? Because there was a similar question that was used last time. But this last time it was amongst adults, this time it's about students. So the answers are rolling in. We'll give it another few seconds. Looks like cannabis might be the winner. But we still have some answers going in. Hopefully I didn't bias the sample there. All right, let's take a look. Oh, this doesn't give the result, does it? We can go back and I'll share the result with folks. Can you
go back?
Yeah. So the majority of people, oh, there we go. Yeah. So the majority of people, we can see here, I think folks can see this, 63% of folks thought that cannabis had the highest rate of past year use. They thought that cigarette use was the third lowest at 4.5%. The second highest rate that people thought, this isn't the actual rates, but people thought, the second majority of people thought 31% for e-cigarette use. So we got cannabis, e-cigarette use, and cigarette in that order, with the majority saying cannabis. Let's take a look at the data. So past year use, the last column is what we're interested in. Look at that. People did have it more or less right. They had it, well, they had it right in the sense that the past year use, 21% for cannabis. E-cigarette use is 19%, and that likely is not a significant difference compared to 21, but at cigarette use is 14%. We look at ever use, it's marginally a little bit higher. Now what's interesting here is we don't include 30-day use, in part because they don't ask 30-day use for a lot of these substances. They do for cigarettes. And if we did have a column that said past 30-day use, I guess I'm not going to ask this question to the group, but I'll just pose it rhetorically. You know, what do you think would be the highest for past 30-day use? And, of course, I think everybody would say cigarette, right? Cigarette is still king. So not to give you the wrong idea, cigarette use is still by far the largest single issue out there, tobacco, cigarette. It's just that this data looks at past year use, and so not to give people the wrong impression that cigarette use would beat them all if we asked past 3 days. That could change in the next couple of years. We don't know. We need to get better measurements out there. We need to get 30-day questions for each of these other substances. So just to, I guess, to drill down a little bit, lifetime use of e-cigarettes, for males, 27%, for females, 18%. So there is a variation in use here by sex. Looking at water pipe, we got lifetime use, we got 14% among 7 to 12. And as one might expect, looking at the older grades, grade 12, 26%. That's quite high. And just as a reference, we presented this number before, 8% amongst 15 years and older. What this is telling you is that water pipe use, like cigar, like e-cigarette, is really strong amongst youth and young adults, right? They're picking up these emerging technologies to a much greater extent than older folks. Cannabis use. We do have this in the past month, actually, it's 14% of students in the past month have used cannabis. 21% tried it in the past year, and we see it by grade, going from 10% in grade 9 up to 37% in grade 12. So, you know, cannabis is out there, and that's, you know, prior to, there's been lots of discourse that youth have heard about the possible legalization of cannabis. And so this is something worth monitoring in the near future with the way the legalization discourse is happening out there currently, and you know it will be legalized likely within the next 2 to 3 years. So there are some scientific advisory committee recommendations from 2010. So these are target interventions to schools, colleges, universities, and workplaces where youth and young adults are at greatest risk. Align cessation and prevention programs, increase media and social marketing. And so as Rob pointed out in terms of the highlights and lowlights, some of these things have taken place in moderation or initial phases. There needs to be much greater intensity to really reach these goals. So, you know, cessation and prevention program alignment, increased media and social marketing really hasn't had much ongoing intense provincial level media and social marketing happening at this point in the province. So we'll stop here for a minute if folks have any questions.
Yeah, we're not. I'm not seeing any questions in the chat box. Again, I encourage you to put your questions in the chat box. We can certainly open the phone lines if people would feel more comfortable posing them through the phone.
Well, I'm just sitting in the room here.
Okay, Nancy, go ahead.
Speak up,
Nancy.
So, I'm just wondering what the factors that you'd attribute that decrease in rate from 23 to 17. I think that was in the 18 to, where was it?
20 to 24.
20 to 24 year olds. Just wondered if you'd like to talk about that a little bit and what factors you see contributing to that.
So I think we've seen for the past several years a decrease in the rates in grades 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been waiting to see, are we going to see that in once people leave high school and go out to university, college, or the workplace?
Mm-hmm.
And so far we haven't seen a whole lot of decrease. There have been some, but not a whole lot. We weren't knowing. You know, were kids just picking it up once they left, or did some of that sort of prevention, denormalization actually work on them as young adults? So I would say that the combination of all our main tobacco control measures is actually showing an effect. Whether, as Sean alluded to, e-cigarettes and cannabis are having an effect on that is very hard to say. I mean, cannabis use has been high in Ontario for some time now. This data is actually probably too old to pick up a lot of what's happened since the talk about legalization.
Yeah.
I wouldn't actually attribute the increase to that. When you look closely at the e-cigarette data, who is not a smoker is picking up e-cigarettes. Nobody. Very few people. There aren't enough of them to capture. People are picking up e-cigarette as a regular sort of established activity. So I'm doubtful, although it is a hypothesis that needs to be further explored. We don't have enough research, and we have proposed to do research of that. We're waiting for the results of our proposal to be able to look more closely in both quantitative and qualitative ways about what is happening when youth transition out of high school and into university, college, or important places.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, so shall we continue then with cessation? Feel free to chime in with any comments or questions as we go through the cessation. So is there a need for an increase in price and tax? We know the answer to that. The SAC had recommended a substantial increase in provincial taxes. You may be asking, why am I talking about taxes now when we're talking about cessation? And the reason is because cessation and taxes are probably the single most effective measure that can be done to make people quit smoking, and we cannot ever forget that. So when we talk about cessation, it is never only about our clinical cessation activities. Those are very important, but standing alone, they are very unlikely to get us too far too fast. Unfortunately, we have yet to move very much on price and tax. We still have the second lowest tax rate in Canada, and we don't even meet the minimal Empower standards when it comes to tax. And I will add, just as a plug, increasing taxes does not lead to contraband. Okay, that's a myth. That's a myth. I think we've talked about it on the show before. Read our editorial in the Canadian Medical Association Journal or our piece on the Ultra website. Also backed up more recently by research of Emmanuel Guindon, our colleague. You can raise taxes, and you're not going to drive tons of people to contraband. This shows you where Ontario stands relative to Quebec. The graph is the total price, and you can see that in Ontario it's at $97 compared to 130. This is for 200 cigarettes compared to Manitoba, where it's $133. Right, that's a big difference, and I think, I don't know this for a fact, but I wager to say that salaries, income in Ontario is generally higher than it would be in Manitoba, I'm kind of thinking.
And contraband's not higher in those jurisdictions with high rates of tax either.
Also true. So we know that if we increase taxation, we are going to increase cessation, and we are going to decrease initiation. Well, how are we doing on quitting behavior? We don't really have much new data to report on this, but we do have 2015 data here because we have from the CAMH monitor. Confidence intervals are wide because we don't have a lot of smokers in this particular survey. You can see if you look between 2014 and 2015 at the far right hand of the graph, you see that there is what looks like a drop in the line, but if you take into account the confidence intervals, there actually is no change in intentions to quit, and actually there hasn't been for a very long time, at least that we're able to measure. So intentions to quit in both the next 30 days, which is the bottom line, and the next 6 months, which is the top line, have not changed substantially. On the other hand, it's always important to point out that half the smokers, more than half of post-smokers, want to quit in the next 6 months. A good number, you know, about a quarter of them want to quit in the next 30 days. That's low-hanging fruit, you would think. Okay. And another indicator we use is how many people have made one or more quit attempts in the past year. We see here also no significant change. It's standing in 2015 at 37% of smokers. So this is, again, according to CAMH Monitor. And we have a poll question for you. What is the percentage of previous year smokers who quit and remain smoke-free for the subsequent 12 months? So, as we know, relapse is an issue. So, take into account what you think quit rates are. Okay, then take into account what you think relapse is and tell us, is it closer to 2%, 5%, 8%, or 10%? of smokers who quit and remain quit for 12 months. Going to, we've got over 60 responses now, so I think we are about to close this poll. And we see that most of you gave the correct answer, which is 2%. So you are educated. Maybe you participated last year. Maybe you've been reading our reports, and maybe you're just smart. So this slide shows us the long-term quit rate. And in 2014, the last time we have good data, 7.9% of past year smokers quit for 30 days or longer. But because our relapse rate is about 79% based on our Ontario-based studies, that means that only 1.7% actually remained quit for 12 months. And that has not changed significantly in the past several years. In the next slide, we show you how we are doing in terms of reaching smokers. And this is with our more clinically based cessation interventions. It includes everything in the top line, including the OHIP billing code by family physicians. And of course, Smokers Helpline and STOP and Ottawa Heart and any other Leave the Pack Behind and the actually the Health Unit Cessation Service as well, the Ontario Drug Benefit as well. So we see that if you include the OHIP billings by physicians, 17% of smokers have been reached in the past year by these, which sounds like, you know, that's a pretty good number. We have never reported it this way. We've been reporting the bottom line. And the bottom line doesn't include the OHIP billing by physicians. And, you know, we've been deliberating about that a lot, and any comments about it are welcome. The reason we haven't included it is because we see that physicians are allowed to bill up to 4 sessions for the initial counseling and then 3 follow-ups. Very few patients are being billed for more than the 1 initial visit. We are feeling that billing for that brief intervention which is happening is of a quality somewhat different than what is happening in most of the other interventions that we're capturing. So we decided to present it both ways, and you can choose which one you think is the better one to use, and your thoughts about that are most welcome. You can see that over the years we've been gradually increasing, which is really important and good news, and this is because the province, I think, has really been pushing this. There is a slight, probably insignificant, well, this is a number, so it's not a matter of statistics, but there is a slight decline in the past year. I'm not sure that's something to be concerned about, but it is something to look into. So this should all be looked at as a sort of a tin opener and look inside. Why have we had a bit of a decrease in the past year and not a continued increase? Oops. So the SAC recommendations about the cessation are basically to have a good integrated system with no wrong door and to create accountability mechanisms. And the Cessation Strategy Advisory Group, which sat a year ago, one of its main recommendations was to make cessation a standard of practice and to have the LHINs actually enter into accountability agreements where cessation would be one of the performance measures. I'm hoping that's still on the table, but we haven't actually seen it happen yet. Other recommendations were about targeting high-risk populations, focusing on innovation, more mass media, and of course aligning cessation and prevention programs. And those of you in the field, you know, you can have your own perceptions about the extent to which this has happened. In our full monitoring report, we do report more closely on this. We have a close look at what is happening in each of the known interventions, how they've changed, how much they're reaching, what we know about their effectiveness. So when you get the report in a week from now, you can look at that more clearly. So we are going to pause here again for questions.
Right. I shall read you the question.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to start with the one, let's see here. All right, the slide that looks at demographics, including occupation, is interesting as a starting point. However, it seems as though we lack data on what motivates smokers to start or quit. Are we talking to smokers? Should we be?
Okay, that's a great question, thank you. Our slide on demographics is something that we have been developing over time, and we just think it's really important for the field to have a good understanding not only of what the different percentage of smoking rates are in different subpopulations, but also what the different numbers are that we're dealing with. I think it's, the count piece is as important as the prevalence piece when it comes to understanding what and how much we should be dealing with different subpopulations. The question about how smokers stop and how we are talking with smokers is really important, also considering the new provincial focus on patient engagement in designing interventions and in doing research. And we have been told this several times over the past years. And indeed, we are now in our new research proposals, including patient engagement at all levels. So having smokers help collaborate with us in designing the research, implementing it, and understanding the effects. I'm convinced that people who are intervening, I want to be convinced, are also doing this. I think that speaking with your colleagues, I'm seeing some nods around the PTCC table here. So I think this is tremendously important. We did at OTRU study on cessation, trying to understand how it is that people are accessing the cessation services. And in that one, we went directly to smokers. We spoke with smokers a lot to understand what they're using, why they're using which services, why they stopped using them, what they want instead, and where they're going back to. I also will say that OTRU has a smokers panel with over 5,000 smokers in it. And now it's true that we rarely speak with them directly, and given your comments, I think that, you know, we will take heed and think about doing that more often, but we do frequently survey them to learn what they're thinking about new interventions before and after they come in.
Okay. Let's take another question. I know we still have to address the protection chapter. Would you say education and targeted programming in terms of prevention would be more effective with young adults or younger school-aged, or the younger school-aged population?
All these questions are great. I wish I had excellent answers to all of them. So for school age, the Scientific Advisory Committee came to the conclusion that, you know, partially in light of the relatively small proportion of school age kids who are smoking, and the evidence about school-based programs, exclusively school-based programs, that a more targeted approach for high-risk youth or high-risk schools or high-risk places where these young people are would be the direction to take. Concerning young adults, we did a systematic review, which we updated about a year ago, and that is on our website. It came as a result of a question from the health units. I don't think that we know enough yet to be able to say that targeted would be the best way to go. So I'm going to stay agnostic on that.
Okay. So Rocky,
just add this note or a little bit about the young students. It's a definitional issue in terms of what you mean by young, but you know, as we know from the results presented, people are starting to smoke when they're entering high school, kind of, you know, grade 10 past year, which they would have been in grade 9. So it seems that there's a transition kind of in that grade 9 year. What we're saying is that what we've said over the years, particularly with our knowledge evaluation support project, is that it's great to present information to students of all ages, including, grade 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, in terms of workshops or assemblies or something like that. But you don't want to run an intensive program with those young grades with the idea that, you know, hey, that's going to prevent them from smoking when they get to high school. The research doesn't support that necessarily. So if you're running kind of intensive interventions, we're suggesting you do it when they're in those high-risk groups, like, you know, grade 9 in high school. Or even just a prevention, you don't want to do an intensive prevention program for grades, you know, 6, 7, maybe even 8. Having said that, it's not that you don't want to mention anything about smoking in those grades, but you don't want to run programs with those grades. Or we're recommending it's better, the effort is better spent in high school for programs.
Yeah.
Okay. Rob and Sean, do you think we have time for one more question and then we can move on to the protection chapter?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question. All right. We noticed that in BC, the taxes are the third lowest in Canada. How do they still have the lowest smoking rate in Canada?
Yeah, so nothing is simple. First of all, they started off lower. Second of all, British Columbia is better on all measures of healthy living than the rest of the country. Thirdly, there's something about the air in the West that creates a different environment. Fourthly, I know that apart from taxation, they have had quite an intensive cessation program that has, I think, been quite successful, and also in the areas of prevention. That's as far as I can tell you without doing some more in-depth research.
Okay. All right.
Okay, shall we continue then?
Yep.
We'll talk about protection a bit. There isn't a lot of new data in this section, so we will go through it fairly quickly. I do want to say in the area of protection that we presented on this show, once again, on these webinars several months ago, the data from our study in collaboration with health units on rates of exposure to secondhand smoke in the outdoor areas that are now that have now been restricted. And we now have new data from the second wave of that. And I don't have the numbers with me, but I'll just say that rates of exposure have gone down, but they're still high. They're still unacceptably high on restaurants and bar patios, in playing fields and playgrounds. So there is more work to do around those areas. We're not finished quite with protection. Workplace exposure, we do have some new data here from the CAMH monitor. So this is past week exposure indoors or in a workplace, indoors or in a work vehicle. And we see that the rate is 13%. It ought to be zero. And so, you know, we still don't have a good understanding of why this is still happening. It ostensibly went up, but again, look at the confidence intervals. They're very big. Still more work apparently needs to be done here. The public place exposure, so this is every day or almost every day being exposed in public places. We see that the rates have not changed, and this is not new data since the previous round. The different bars are for different age groups. Age 12 to 18 is the lower bar. I can't see which one is
right. Just hit this.
Okay. Anyhow.
Yeah, it's higher. 12 to 18 higher.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. 12 to 18 is 25% in 2014, and age 12 plus is 15%. So we have a little bit of a technical issue in seeing the colors here. And it's not my color blindedness this time. Exposure in vehicles, 5% of 12-year-olds were exposed, of 12 to 15-year-olds were exposed in 2014. 14. We don't have new data on that. And you see the trend here age 12 plus is the green line on the bottom, and 12 to 15 is the purple line. So we see as of 2014 that we haven't completely obliterated this, although it's much lower than it was years ago. And secondhand smoke exposure at home, this is not multi-unit dwellings, this is at home anywhere, is still in 2018 at around 18% for 12 to 18-year-olds and 3% for others, and that is still
8%.
Too high. So okay, I may have missed that one out. Public support for smoking bans. This is from 2015, so this is new data that you haven't seen before. So the proportion of respondents who agreed that smoking should be banned in playgrounds, outdoor recreational facilities, and parks and beaches is very high. 95% children, why it's not 100%, I will never understand. Outdoor recreation facilities, we're at 86%, and parks and beaches, we have 77%. And you see the differences between current smokers, former smokers, and never smokers. The data that I just spoke to was the never smokers, and not surprisingly, the smokers or former smokers are somewhat higher. And we see, apart from parks and beaches, that even the majority of smokers support bans at outdoor recreation facilities and at children's playgrounds. The SAC recommendations around this was to broaden the SFOA to cover more areas, and that has happened partially, develop more social norm change interventions, and to maximize compliance and enforcement. It's clear that we don't have complete compliance with the new bans. I'm wondering if we should at this point go through the conclusion slides and then do the questions.
Sure.
Okay, so just to wrap it up to drill in some of the key points. So overall, most of the MPOWER standards are in place, but not completely, and several of the SAC recommendations remain unfulfilled. There's a downward trend for youth, and we are starting to see a positive trend in those younger adults, but not yet in the older young adults, and the emerging products is a big question mark. And we need a lot more better research, both quantitative and qualitative, to really understand, especially as the e-cigarette market is constantly changing, the heat not burns are coming in, and marijuana is not yet legalized, but will be soon, and it, for some people, I think they think it already is legalized. In cessation, we are hoping that all of the new efforts are going to show greater gains in the future. Reach is not going up perhaps as much as we would have liked. And I will say that unless we do taxation and other population-based measures, we're unlikely to see the clinically-based cessation interventions where a lot of focus is made having a whole lot of gain. And in protection, progress is strong in many areas, but we still do have exposure and, still 13% of people being exposed in workplaces and kids being exposed anywhere continues to be a concern. That's it for today, folks.
Okay. So let's revisit some of the questions we've got in the chat box. Okay, so of all the indicators you mentioned for cessation, which indicator do you think best represents the Ontario cessation situation?
Possible question.
Yeah, in the public health standards and the performance measurement around the public health standards, the government had to choose two tobacco indicators. And we stood on our rear feet and said, no way. So I'm not even going to venture an answer to that one because we need to be looking at all of them. a more distal measure, which is used internationally as a marker, is quit attempts. So we know that we need to drive out quit attempts. I'm not going to say that is the one that I would look at, but I will say that that is an important one.
Okay. Good. Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, you know, evaluation, Rob and I are evaluators, and it's about telling a story. And so to tell a story, you can't pick one indicator. You got to tell us, you know, a story with multiple lines. So, you know, it's relevant with respect to this issue that, you know, 16% of the population smoke, that 25% want to quit in the next 30 days, 50-odd percent want to quit in the next 6 months, and, you know, such and such have quit one or more times in the past year. So that all kind of comes together to say that there's, you know, there's a burden of tobacco in the province, that people are ready to quit, and some people are quitting, but we need to increase quit attempts. And more importantly, we need to get, you know, more people making quit attempts. We're not likely to change the success rate of quitting. It's harder to do. It's better to get more people into the current system, quitting at the rates that the current system is providing. The more people you can get in, you're going to get results. Now, if you can change the quit rates, well, by all means, you know, you always want to improve and make bigger and better programs, but you want to get more people making quit attempts, because if more people make quit attempts, a portion of them will be successful, and that's how you're going to get a population level effect.
Also, keep in mind always 2 million smokers approximately in Ontario. How many of them are actually quitting for 12 months? 1.7%.
Right.
Got a long way to go.
Yeah, so you want to get more people to make a quit attempt.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. Do we know how much it costs to reach 7 to 13% of smokers? Do we know how much it costs to reach 7 to 13% of the smokers last year? If so, do you have opinions on whether it can be done more cost effectively?
So I'll just start by saying that a study that we've done and studies that others have done also, but we looked at the major Ontario cessation providers, they are all extremely cost effective. So the more money you put into the providing cessation, the better results you're going to have, and you will always be cost effective, much more cost effective than almost any other health intervention that we know of. So, I mean, that's my general response. I don't know precisely how much it costs to reach this the 7% or 13% of smokers last year. I do think that they are all cost effective, and also all of the providers are reaching different populations. Always really important to keep that in mind. So that's the best answer I can offer.
Yeah. I'll say that, you know, to reach that number of people, it's necessary to spend that much money. And it's from a clinical perspective. You're reaching people from a kind of a one-on-one or group-to-group counseling. I think in addition to that, you need to spend money at the population level, which will drive people to these services. So, for instance, if you increase taxes, if you increase social marketing, mass media, intensive duration, every day someone should be seeing messages out there about quitting or about not smoking in front of people or tobacco industry denorm. All those population level approaches will drive people to quit either on their own cold turkey or to cessation interventions that are in the province. So I think it's not a matter of shuffling the money around. I think more money needs to be spent at all facets, and in particular the population level, to get people to quit in the province. It can't be done. I mean, one other thing to mention is that you can't achieve success for the smoke-free Ontario strategy if you take merely a clinical approach, because you can't see that. You can't see, you know, there's 2 million smokers in the province. You can't see that much money. You can't see that many people to make any difference at a population level. You need a combined approach of a clinical perspective and a population perspective, and arguably both need to be raised up in terms of money.
Okay.
So it's not one or the other, it's both.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Do you think evidence that the tobacco industry has significantly raised its own prices recently would have any impact on attitudes about tobacco use?
I think, you know, all of the tobacco industry denorm, raising that as part of tobacco industry denorm might help somewhat. I don't think in of itself, others would be more expert than us on the communication value of that.
I mean, there may be a messaging because, I mean, you know, the industry and its confederates go into the minister's office and say, don't raise taxes. It's, you know, you're going to lead to contraband. And so they're constantly pushing this message. I know they're reaching out to all the MPs or, you know, several MPs in the province. And then the industry, the tobacco manufacturers go turn around and they raise taxes two or three times a year. So there are mixed messages there, right? So if that was brought forth in terms of a communication plan, you know, at least, you know, it, to the extent that the Ministry of Finance would understand that, you know, they're saying don't raise taxes, but they're raising their price, to the extent that you could defeat that argument that they're perpetuating and raise taxes, that would have a benefit, a positive benefit for public health in Ontario.
Yeah, so I see the next question by Janine. Would you not argue that you introduced the prevention program before grade 9 to prevent uptake in grade 9? Yeah, I think Sean probably overstated a little bit the argument. The point isn't that there shouldn't be any prevention done in schools before grade 9. It's a question of degree and intensity.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense maybe in grade 6. Grade 3, it doesn't make sense, but, you know, there's a fine line there, grade 8, grade 9, because if you're, you know, maybe to prepare people going into high school would make sense.
Yeah, and then can we post the link to the systematic review on young adults? Yes, absolutely, we can share that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, I'm not seeing any other questions coming into the chat box. So if anybody has any last-minute burning questions, please type them in now. I'll just wait another few seconds to see if anybody has anything. Okay. All right. I think I'll move on. So I would like to thank everyone who joined the webinar today, and a special thank you to Dr. Rob Schwartz and Dr. Sean O'Connor. Following this webinar, you'll be sent an email that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If everyone could kindly take a few moments to complete the evaluation, it would be greatly appreciated. Your input will help us to improve webinars and host future learning opportunities that meet your needs. The slide deck, as well as the audio and video recordings of the webinar, will be made available on our website in the near future. As you heard earlier on in the webinar, the deck will be available next week, timing with the report release. And a link to the page will be included in an email. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Bye-bye.